just like that.
So you were right. We're defending her.
Yeah. See, I defended her honor all this time, and she made me look good. I like it. I like it. Got a fun show today. I think it's going to be a fun show.
It's going to be an amazing show.
Yeah.
Guaranteed.
David Spivey Jr. is in the house.
Yes, sir.
And he's got a past that we're going to discuss. And Killian. Did I say that in an Irish way, sort of?
Yeah, it sounded all right.
You say it.
Killian.
Killian.
Yeah, Killian Dunn.
Killian Dunn.
Yeah.
So good. But so good. Conor McGregor fan. I instantly like you for that reason.
I am. Well, he's, you know, he's the pride of Ireland.
Well, let's just talk about that real quick.
Yeah.
The UFC didn't announce it yet, but Conor claims June 29th, International Fight Week, Conor versus Michael Chandler at 185. Could that be right?
I saw that. Jeez, I don't know. I feel like he can do it.
The king gets what he wants.
Yeah, he can do it.
And I'm okay with it.
But that being said, I mean, the second it gets... And then it's like, I have to go to it.
100%. Have you been to his fights before?
I've never been to one of his
fights.
Oh,
it's crazy.
No, never.
It's almost scary. I think all of Ireland shows up.
I've seen the videos.
It's insane. I saw Conor versus Mendez. Mm-hmm. So I was at that fight. I was at Conor Nate 2.
Oh, wow.
I was at. I didn't see the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at Conor Aldo.
Wow.
And I was at Conor Khabib, and I was at Conor Mayweather.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so I am pro Conor all the way.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's
which
awesome.
Kind of sucks because I do love Chandler, too.
Right.
But if I had to pick.
You'd pick Conor?
It's Conor. Good. Yeah.
We like that.
Somebody may be mad at you for that.
Yeah, no, right? Can't be. Do you have a fight prediction if it is Conor Chandler?
Oh, Matt, well, if I say anything other than McGregor,
right.
I can't go back to Ireland.
But can you be like, that's true, they won't let you in.
Yeah.
But can you pick the round? Does it go to the distance? What do you think?
I really don't know. If Conor's going up a weight, I could see it not going all the way. I don't know. I'm always going to say McGregor because I am a fan.
Me too.
And I'm Irish, of course. But I don't see it going all the way.
I'm going to make a bold prediction, and this is not anything against Chandler, because, again, Chandler is, literally my number two favorite behind Conor. I think it's Conor round one.
Really?
I do, just because, Chandler is... Chandler, if he wrestled, would out-wrestle him and would win the fight, but I just don't... I think Chandler is... He's for the people, and he's for the fans, and he just wants it to be exciting, and he's, going to go out there, and he's going to go toe-to-toe. And he's very aggressive, and Conor fights really well backing up, and he counters really well backing up with that left, and I just think that's what it's going to look like.
Yep. Well, as an Irishman, you know where my loyalties stand.
Yeah.
I'll say no more.
And you're an author.
I am.
Was this the first book you wrote, or?
That's my fourth book.
This was your fourth book.
Yep.
This one happens to be about this man right next to me. I like it. So tell me, I don't know which way I want to go with this. How did you guys even meet?
All right, so... I was doing private security.
Okay.
And I happened to work an event that him and his buddy, Conor, was throwing on New Year's Eve.
Okay.
And so met Conor. I was at the front desk checking tickets. Just so happened we started talking. And then I started, I'm doing YouTube as well. I'm trying to get out there. My goal is to be a motivational speaker. He's like, what's your content? I'm like, motivation. He's like, oh, okay. And then so we talked a little bit. I didn't think it really would go too far because... A lot of people just talk, and then once you turn around, they're like, what was that guy's name again?
Yeah.
So he checked my stuff out, called this guy all excited, and he checked it out. Just so happened I went to Snake Pit, which is a networking event that they throw, and saw Killian outside, and he was like, yo, Dave, I've been watching your content nonstop, bro. I want to write a book about you. I'm like, hell yeah, let's do it. He's like, you sure? I'm like, dude, let's do it. As soon as you're ready, I'm ready. He's like, all right, cool. And then it actually created a friendship brotherhood because now we're hella close. So it's all right, cool. So that's how it started.
What is that process like? Is it you sitting down basically doing this with him but not on a microphone, almost an interview and getting the whole story out and taking notes kind of thing? And
yeah, kind of. We, like Dave said, I mean, I watched all of his shit. When I found out about it, I watched, I want to say, every video. So I had a really good understanding of what happened and how Dave felt about it. So basically, over the course of a month, we would just chat four times a week, probably for an hour or two every time. I would come prepared with questions, but categorize. So one day I would come in and be like, okay, today we're going to talk about, like, you know, what being a member of a gang is like in prison. And if you, like, step out of line, what happens to you? So keeping it, like, real specific. But then we'd have days where, like, we'd have fun days. We'd be like, all right, now talk to me about women. Like, talk to me about this.
To get to know him, because you need to know who he is, what he's like.
No, he asks about women so he can learn how to get them.
He's also a bastard. Yeah, he'll throw me under the bus. But yeah, so he hit the nail on the head. Like, it was an interview process, but we became wicked close.
Yeah.
Like, I wrote the book from Dave's perspective. So it's a first person perspective. Like,
okay,
I had to essentially just understand how Dave, like, thinks and how he feels and just all of the above. And so when I was writing the book, I felt really connected to him and we would talk all the time. I mean, dude, even the book's been out for a few months now. Like, my mom has texted Dave. Like, my family my family are going to be in LA in like a month and a half. And they're like, when can we meet Dave? I was like, the second you get here, like, he'd love to meet you. So it's awesome, dude. I've written other books and I've written other books about people. And Dave is by far the closest I've ever gotten to anyone.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So now with all that said, let's tell the people, what did you do? So you were incarcerated for 15 years?
Yes. So I was incarcerated for 15 years, but I originally had a life sentence.
Oh.
Yeah. I was arrested at the age of 17 for first degree murder, attempted murder, shooting an occupied dwelling, and later add charge for a conspiracy to commit first degree murder, all with gang enhancements.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is rude to ask, but you did it?
Yes.
Yeah. And you were 17?
Yes.
And they tried you as an adult, obviously?
Yes.
What was that like? I mean, when you did it, you're young and you're probably working off adrenaline and whatever goes with all that. And then when you finally get caught, like, how soon after you did it did you get caught?
Down the street.
Really?
Yeah.
And when you got caught, were you, I would imagine you're probably so young, you're like, this isn't nothing, I'll get out? Or were you like, I'm fucked?
You know what? I was more so thinking like, fuck. You know, because I always, like, tell people, like, prior to incarceration, like, I always kind of have that, like, I didn't give a fuck about anything attitude. Like, I always tell people, like, I devalued myself. Like, I didn't have value in myself.
Yeah.
So, of course, I didn't think you were anything. So I just didn't give a shit about anybody.
Right.
Other than, like, promoting the agenda of my neighborhood. And so when I remember being in the back seat just thinking to myself, like, yeah, you fucked up this time.
Yeah.
You know, because it wasn't my first time being incarcerated. Like, I was going to juvenile hall. My mom would come pick me up, you know. And then it was like, all right, you know, mom, you know, driving in the car, I'm not going to keep me. I'm like, I know, mom, I know. And in my head, I was thinking, like, I don't give a fuck, you know? And so, like, the night of the crime, I was sitting in the back seat, and I was just thinking, like, I could hear everything my mom said, every wise word. Just like, you know, these guys aren't your friends. These guys are going to lead you this way. You're ruining yourself. You're throwing away all the potential that God has given you. And I want to say, like, and I always tell people, like, you would think that that was enough to be, like, immediate, like, you know, I got to change. I got to do something different. But, like, no, this is a part of the lifestyle. Like, I've just entered the pinnacle of gangbanging.
Right.
You know, I'm going to jail for murder.
This is in L.A.?
This is in Inglewood, California.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of where it was at. I had moments where I wasn't remorseful about the crime. I was just sad about being incarcerated.
Right, at the time.
Yes.
Right, right. Wow. And public defender, I would imagine.
So I had a private attorney.
Okay.
And shout out James Purnell Cooper III, because he did a great job. Even, and I always tell people that, even though I got a life sentence, because he really, like, he defended me to the best of his abilities.
Yeah.
And so I always say that it didn't really matter who I had, because, like, justice was served. I deserved everything I got.
At what point did remorse set in?
I want to say when my mother passed away.
Hmm.
You know, I had just got to prison in December 2nd of 2010, and she died January 18th, 2011, from lupus. And so I remember just breaking down, crying in my cell, and then it just hit me, like, you know, you're responsible for somebody else's family feeling like this, right?
Hmm.
And that's when I was like, oh, shit. And then, like, the next year, I was in Pelican Bay, and my little brother was, he succumbed to gunshot wounds. And so I was just like, okay, so this is how it feels.
Right.
Okay, I don't want nobody else's family feeling like this.
Hmm.
And so even if I never get out of prison, I wanted to change my life just in honor of the victim, their family, and my family, because I victimized my family as well with my lifestyle.
Sure. Right. So you robbed them of hanging out with you in a different way, right?
Well, I killed my mom because she had lupus. And so with me getting life in prison, she stressed herself to death.
Yeah.
So her organs started failing. So that was another victim of this crime. Mm. So I was like, you know what? I need to live my life in a way that I can make everybody proud of me, that I'm not, and I always tell people, I never excuse my heinous actions. Like, everything that I got was everything I deserved.
Yeah.
And so I just changed my life, not in the effort like, oh, well, if I be a good boy, they'll let me out of jail. It was just like, no, I need to just be a good man in order to, even if I die in prison blues, I can die happy because I know that I did everything in my power to honor their lives.
Let me ask you this. Do you feel you deserve to be out?
I'll always say no, I didn't deserve. And so it's kind of like crazy because, so my gang name was Baby Roscoe. And I used to always tell guys when I was in prison, like, you know what? They'll give David another chance, but Roscoe must die.
Mm.
So that I always tell people that was my final murder. I killed that guy off. So to say that I deserve, no, it's just I was able to be blessed enough to receive mercy.
Yeah.
You know, because justice was served.
And you got sentenced for life.
I got 100 years of life.
So how did that change? What, just good behavior?
So, all right, sentencing laws, at trial, well, at sentencing, we had the 35 to life for the conspiracy state, so it was 65. Motions there, taking some time off, so I ended up with 58 years of life. And so I remember sitting inside of my cell watching the Grammys, no, the Oscars.
Mm.
And I remember they were singing the song Freedom. This is when the movie Selma had just came out. And I remember comments saying, oh, you know, let's end mass incarceration. Let's end this and that. And I remember telling my celly, who was actually one of, like, my best friends from the streets, I'm like, bro, you better get your shit together. He's like, why? I'm like, they're going to let people out who, like, really decide to change their lives. So got my first step was, like, to get closer to God because I knew that I needed, like, a spiritual anchor in order to even get back to my human side. So because I tell people all the time, like, I was living animalistic. Yeah. You know, my actions were all animalistic. So got closer to God, started like reading the Bible a lot. I had a job in a chapel when I was in Pelican Bay State Prison. I always say that job saved my life because I was always at work. So like I missed out on a lot of BS.
Yep.
And ended up getting my points dropped, going to a level 3 prison in California, which is a lower level. It was still kind of like hectic. And so
dangerous in there.
Yeah. Yep. Like, even in that yard, I've seen guys stabbed like damn near to death. And I remember this Asian guy, and I always tell this story is always funny to me because he was an Asian dude who didn't gangbang, but he ran with the Southsiders.
Okay.
And he asked me, like, hey, you want to go to college? And I'm like,
that's almost a movie right there.
Yeah, exactly. It is.
It's like another book you need to write.
Right. Let's find that guy. Yeah. And so he's like, hey, you want to go to college? And I'm like, dude, I don't got no fucking money to go to college. He's like, no, it's like you can do a bog waiver and this, and so that kind of like started it. I'll say the group that changed my life was addiction counseling program, and shout out to my man Raynard Courtney because he asked a question at the end of class. He said, "What made what you did acceptable?" So I shut my hand up. He said, "No. Go back in the cell and think about it." And so I'm in the cell. I'm thinking, well, it was a lifestyle. No, that's shallow. Because in this group, they would call you on bullshit. So you can say some stuff like, oh, you know, what made it acceptable is, you know, it's my lifestyle. And somebody be like, I'm going to call bullshit on him. And then now, like, you're in the hot seat. And I'm, like, the dude who doesn't like the hot seat.
Yeah.
I prefer to put other people in the hot seat. So I'm in a cell. I'm like, all right, well, it was either them or me. No, that's bullshit. And then it finally came to me. I'm selfish. And to hear that out loud, I'm like, oh, shit, that, like, really, really sucked. Because I was selfish towards my family. Like, it was in that moment, like, dude, you didn't really love your mom. You didn't really love your brother. You didn't even love yourself. And so that like started the change, like the dynamic change. I will say that was the pendulum shift. And so I just dived into self-help like freaking crazy, like it was no tomorrow.
Yeah.
You would think they had girls in self-help classes the way I went to them, you know? And it was like, I just need to get in here and get some knowledge. I need to be better. Cause like I said, it was not about whether I could go home or not. It was just like, I want to be able to live with myself. Right. Because now I've admitted I was selfish. Now I'm starting to see these character defects in myself. And I'm not cool with the person I'm seeing or the lack of a person that I'm seeing. And so eventually through that, through going to self-help classes, I started doing vocational classes. I'm like, I used to always say I did an auto body class. And I'm like, I'm only taking this class because if I have a son one day, I want to teach him this stuff.
Mm.
You know, I didn't have a dad to teach me tools. So I learned that. I went from there to masonry. Masonry to building technology. And so just kept doing stuff. And shout out Governor Brown, man, Jerry Brown. He decided to commute my sentence.
Wow. Was that a tough, like, from the time you heard that it was possible that you were going to get out to you actually getting out, how much time was that?
That was a matter of 3 years.
Wow. And was that, like, torture in a way?
It actually was, because, like, once you know that you have action at going home, you know that you can't do anything stupid.
Right.
Because then it's like, it's kind of like just grabbing a knife and just stabbing yourself right. over and over. You're like, die, dumbass, die.
And I would imagine sometimes stupid finds you in there, and I don't want to say you don't have a choice, but you could be in a situation where you don't have a choice, right? You there might have so to get into it with somebody, and you're just going to be guilty because you got into it with somebody, right?
Correct. There's like, and the crazy thing about prison, especially, like, because I was on the main line, and so it's like, it's all these super duper unwritten rules that right. everybody knows. So, you know, racial riot kicks off. It's like, fuck.
Right.
I got to do this. And, you know, so, dude, my prayer every night was like, God, keep this yard safe. Let everybody get along.
Yeah.
And if something does happen, let me be a visitant. Let me be somewhere where I have a right. valid excuse. Like, man, what happened, man? I was at school, you know? Right. Like, so that was definitely hard. But you know what? I still had warped beliefs. Even knowing that I had action at going home, because I remember sitting and visiting with both my aunts, their maternal aunts. And so I was just like, look, I do want to go home. I'm going to do everything I can, but I'm not going to be the guy who's getting slapped and making an excuse like, oh, man, he better be lucky I want to go home. I'm like, if somebody hits me, we're going to fight like two gophers.
Right.
You know, and they was like, you know what? We understand that and we can respect that. You know, right. Thank God.
Because it's also dangerous for you not to do that.
Exactly.
Right?
I always say I'd rather have one fight than have to go through 100 fights because I didn't have that one fight.
Right.
So that's kind of what it was. Even when I went to board, I was denied parole for 3 years. And I thought I was going to actually get parole on the first shot. And so I was like, yeah, I think I did my thing, man. And they were like, yeah, your gang ties are still too, like, fresh. And so they denied me parole for 3 years, but they actually set the record up for me to be advanced to come back early. So I ended up going back to board in 18 months, and I didn't think I was going to get parole at that hearing.
Yeah.
And when they said it, I was just like, but that was the hardest time that I did in prison after being found suitable for parole, because you have 150 days for your case to be reviewed. All the board commissioners have 120 days, and then the governor has an extra 30 days because of the first degree murder.
Got it.
So and you can't even get a warning.
Right.
Or it's like, give me freedom back. Wow. So I sweat. I remember one time running from work trying to meet an unlock. And I didn't know that the guard was talking to me. And thank God that dude didn't lay the yard down and write me up, because it would have been like, yep. And so that was the hardest time. I got out in 120 days after that, but that was the toughest time in prison.
Before we started the show, I was telling you about this guy, Adam Clausen, who does his podcast here called Gritability. And Adam was sentenced to 213 years and got out in 20. And I was telling you that he changed my view on how I think about people that have been incarcerated. Because I used to be like, you know, like you see when the knockout game was a thing?
Right.
And there's just a young guy walking down the street and he just punches an old man, knocks him out, and just keeps going. Like, I was like, fuck that guy. We don't need him. Lock him up for life. Like, fuck him. That's just kind of been my stance on it. And Adam really changed how I feel about that. Like, people can absolutely change. And when you're young, you do some stupid things. We've all done stupid things when we're young. And you guys did some really stupid things, right?
Yeah.
Adam changed how I view about that. And, you know, it was interesting. And then you said you had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I have a very unpopular opinion on that, because doing so much time, there are guys who I feel should never see society again, because some people are just like that, just evil, that insidious. But I always say, as far as the guys, and I always say that's my job. you know, to change that narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Because I definitely understand for somebody who's law-abiding, somebody who doesn't do crime, somebody who isn't part of a gang, to take that view, because it's like, dude, I worked my ass off to get this stuff, and then you just decide to break in my house and take everything, and now you're just living it up. So I always say, like, it's guys like me, guys like Adam, who have to do everything in our power to show, no, rehabilitation is real. Redemption is a real thing.
Right.
You know, it's just like going to the gym. If you're fat on January 1st, but you dedicate yourself to working out and eating healthy, you'll look good.
Yep.
And so that's what rehabilitation is about. It's about dedicating your life to change. And if you do it correctly and you are doing it honestly and sincerely, it's going to be evident. Because so many people, when I talk to them, they're like, wait a minute, you were in prison?
Right.
For murder?
Yeah.
Fuck out of here.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, dude, like, I keep this with me all the time. And I keep this not to show off, but as a reminder for myself, like, when I think days are hard out here, I always keep my freaking prison ID to remember that there's no day that it was as hard as this day. And so whatever I'm going through out here, it's not this.
Yeah.
You know, and it keeps me humble.
Yeah. Wow. So when you were 17, you went in.
Yes.
Right? You're in there with men. You're in there with 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds?
Well, at 17, I was in, and it's crazy. I wish we could have a picture of it, but they have, like, this compound.
Okay.
At Silmar Juvenile Hall. And I remember going there in the middle of the night thinking, like, I'm in fucking prison already? I was like, what? I remember telling the dude, I'm like, how they send me to prison already? Because it's, like, in the middle of the juvenile hall, barbed wire, cameras everywhere.
Yeah.
You're shackled from head to toe. And I'm just like, what the? And that is, like, off the hook. Like, it's a bunch of freaking 13 to 17-year-old kids who all don't give a fuck, who are all just like, I'm going to do everything to show you that my neighborhood is better than yours. And it's just like, I remember this one Hispanic kid got paralyzed from the neck down in there.
Wow.
Because his dad got green light, and they attacked him. And I was just like, whoa, shit. Like, it was, like, crazy stuff. And then I remember going to the county, LA County Jail, like, which is, like, one of the most infamous jails in the United States.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, I was, like, 155 pounds. And I'm just like, what the fuck? And I'm, like, seeing, like, big-ass Samoans and black dudes and, like, that are just, like, jacked up. I'm like, I remember, like, what? I'm going to have to fight this dude? Like,
right.
I'm like, I remember one time seeing this, like, really buff dude, and I was like, I just hope he doesn't say, like, enemy neighborhood. Uh-huh. Like, I'm praying to God this dude doesn't say something that my neighborhood opposes, and I'm just like, and he didn't. I was like, oh, thank God. But it made me start working out more and stuff like that. But, no, it's, like, it's really, really, it is scary. I'm not, like, I always say, I'm not the dude that's like, oh, no, it wasn't nothing. Like, no,
yeah.
Every day is scary, because when people ask me, like, what is jail like? I'm like, all right, imagine from the moment you get out of your bed, you're tense.
Right.
You're ready for anything.
Right.
And that's just in your room.
In your room.
So imagine now when you walk outside.
Because you're in
your
with
home.
One other guy?
Yes.
Okay.
So, and you got, because you have to watch your celly as well, because I've seen guys drinking coffee, playing cards, and in the next, like, 30 minutes, one of them is attacking the other one.
Just for whatever.
Whatever the reason may be.
Perceived disrespect.
It could be perceived disrespect. You don't know that your name's in the hat. You know, because sometimes a lot of guys slip through the cracks so much. There was a guy who snitched on somebody in, like, 1988, like the year I was born. And he wasn't, it didn't catch up to him until, like, 2015. And it's like, but you never know.
Wow.
These were the guys he was just sharing food with and walking laps with, slamming him on his head and breaking his nose and making him shit himself. So it's like, imagine that. Imagine your best friend is the person that's going to get you. The person you trust the most. The guy that you walk to the store with. The guy that you, hey, bro, I just had my first date. Hey, bro, I think she likes me. Hey. And he's like, oh, yeah, hey, man, come over here real quick. Let me talk to you. He's like, damn, look over there. And you, bam, he's knocked you out. And he's just kicking your ass relentlessly. You're already knocked out, but he's just punishing you until the cops get there.
Right.
You know, so it's like, that's what prison's like.
24/7. Is there such thing as a good day in there?
Any day that you make it. You know, because
right.
Anything can happen. That's the thing. Like, prison has the most variables.
Right.
You know, you can. I've seen guys on their way to a visit, and a riot kicks off. So now your family has driven all the way to, because prisons are always so far out.
Right.
And so now your mom, dad, your girlfriend, your kids drive for 2-3 hours, only to be told, "Sorry, we got to
business canceled. Right?
He's going to the hole, or yeah, we're shutting it down." Everybody back to it's like, what the fuck? Wow. No reimbursement on gas, like nothing.
Right, right.
And the guards, like, they don't have sympathy to tell you, like, "Hey, I'm sorry to tell you, like, we're locked." They're just like, "All right, visiting's over. Everybody got to get." You're like, "Whoa, what the fuck?"
Right, right.
Where's my kid at?
I was going to ask you what the guards are like. Are they, how crooked is that side of things?
So you know what? You have, like anything, you got people who take what they do serious.
Yeah.
And people who just don't give a fuck. And so that's the thing. Like, and that's what I always remind people about when they hear prisoners. You know, because I remember asking the person, I said, you hear prison, you hear my story, and all of a sudden your guard goes up. You have all these preconceived notions. But you'll help the guy who walking outside whose car broke down, but you don't know that this guy is a mass murderer. You don't know right. this guy. So you're only judging me because of what you think prison is like.
Right.
And so that's the same thing like with the guards. You know, you got some guards that are like, they come in here, they do their job. They're not assholes about it. You got some guards who, for the most part, were getting picked on all the time by the guys who are now in prison. And so, like, this is their time to get their lick back. I remember we had this one guard. We used to call him Stewie. I'm talking about a little short guy with a big head. And he was vindictive.
Right.
Then you got some guards who are like, "Yo, I can make like $100,000 in like 3 months here."
So really?
Yeah.
Doing just like helping bring stuff in and that kind
just
of stuff?
Just off of cell phones.
Really?
Think about the cheap-ass cell phones at a Walmart that you might pay $30 for. On any given day, you can sell it for at least $1,000 in prison.
How much?
$1,000.
Really?
Cash, tax-free.
So you're allowed to have a phone?
You're not.
Oh, you're not. So they sneak it in and yeah. you can just talk quietly, whatever.
Yeah, I remember, because I had a cell phone, I remember watching Hulu. I was watching Power. And I was so caught up on Power that I didn't hear the guard walk by.
Oh, no.
But I had already had a plan for that. The way I would sit, if you walk by, it looks like I'm either asleep or praying. And so he flashed a light inside the cell, and I just remember telling myself, like, don't move. Like, I was kind of like a panther or something like that. And I was just like, and then he walked by, and I was like, damn, I wonder who that is. And it was this one CO who does his job to a T. Like, he's...
By the book.
He's not unfair.
Mm-hmm.
I always say he's very fair because it's like, you broke the rules, buddy. You got to pay. But then he doesn't, like, go out of his way to fuck over you. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So I looked. I'm like, fuck. I'm like, oh, shit. But then I remember. So I was watching him from my cell, and he happened to go to another cell, and he was, like, looking. And I was like, okay, he didn't do that to me. So I was like, all right, I'm going to wait. All right, cool. And so I just pulled the phone back out. But, I mean, having a cell phone – it's like super cat and mouse game because I remember teaching CGA, which is Criminal Gangs Anonymous. I'm like, dude, think about the insanity that the mindset that we have of having a cell phone. You know, we think, okay, I'm going to stash it here. Like, you know, the guards don't have a time limit on how long they could be in your cell searching it. You know, it's not like Domino's Pizza 5 minutes or less.
Right.
It's like, I'm going to sit in here. I'm going to go through. And you have guards like that.
Right.
Like with the book. People like to put things in the books, and the guards know that. And you have some guards who'll just pick the book up, shake it, nothing comes out. It is what it is. You got some guards that will go page by page by page of a 1,500-page book.
Wow.
And on page 1345, there's drugs.
Right.
And prisoners always get really pissed off about that. Like, man, you're a punk-ass bitch. Why did you do that? You didn't have to do it. Like, no, that's what they get hired to do. You know, they get hired to make sure the jails are safe.
Right.
So that's my thing on guards. It's a love-hate relationship because you got some guards that really, like, have empathy for the inmates, but they know that they can't truly show it or they'll be ostracized by their community. They're, you know, because it's a gang as well with yeah. them. They have a gang mentality too.
Yeah.
You know, it's us versus them, and that's just essentially how gangs operate. And so you got, you know, just like with your perception on prisoners before you met
sure Adam yeah.
yeah and so now it's like you meet guards that, you know, we all say, man, fuck them guards. But then you got guards that, like, show you, like, love that you, like, really desperately need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, man.
From a normal person.
Right. Can I call my dad? Man, he's kind of sick. I know the phone. Go ahead. I'll leave it on. Just go back when you're done. He's like, whoa. And you got some guards like, I don't give a fuck.
Right.
What are you going to do about it?
Was this your first time talking to someone that had ever done anything like this or been involved in gangs and that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah.
So this was all new for you?
Yeah, this was, everything was
all new. Were you just blown away by the stories? Because
I was completely fucking blown away.
Yeah.
At every like, I was captivated from the very first video that I watched of Dave's.
And then were you also, like, just in the short time I've known him now, sitting here 36 minutes, whatever it is, like, I can't even picture this guy was a monster.
Yeah.
Like I can't even, I don't, like, and by the way, when I saw today on Instagram, I just did a quick little thing, and I just saw that you were incarcerated 15 years. I had no clue why. So when you sat down, I had no clue what you were going to say. I was actually shocked that it was murder. I thought it was going to be drugs. It's like, shocked. Like, so you went through all of that with him, like
yeah,
right?
I mean, yeah. I was definitely shocked when I first heard, because that night that Dave did security at the event that I was throwing with my buddy, I mean, we just kind of shot the shit for a couple hours. Like, we were, like, nobody really went to the event. Like, it was kind of a dull event. Yep. So we had a lot of time just kind of fucking around. And I just thought he was a good dude. And then, yeah, I heard from my buddy Connor. He's like, yo, you got to watch Dave's videos. Then watched the videos and saw Dave at an event maybe a couple months later. And it's actually really funny. I don't know if I've ever talked about this with you, but that night, you know, we were having a few drinks and I was just so interested. Like, I was just asking him, I was like, but I would preface every time, I was like, listen, like, if you want me to stop asking you questions, sure, like, just tell me, like,
right.
But I was so intrigued. And then I remember these two, this girl and this guy came over that I, like, kind of knew a little bit, and they kind of joined the conversation. They didn't know that we were talking about Dave.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were like, oh, so what, like, what are you guys talking about? And Dave was like, oh, we're talking about my time in prison. And the look on these people's faces were just like, like, they were like, what? Like, couldn't believe it. They got so awkward about us. And I just remember being like, oh, I got to be the guy to write this fucking story. Like, I didn't feel awkward about it at all. I felt super connected to Dave right away. The only challenge was, like, I had to understand,
right,
like, all of this shit.
Right.
So that's why it took months to understand. I don't even want to say that I still understand it. Like, the book, it's not really a prison book. Like, it's not really a gang book. I kind of, like, see it as a motivational book.
Yeah.
Like, cause it's all,
I like that.
Yeah. It's all, like, first person narrative, all inside Dave's head. The plot just takes place in prison. Like, it's all in prison. Every other chapter is like a dream or a nightmare. So it's super psychological. And so my main focus was, yeah, I knew what Dave did. I knew how much time he got. I knew that there was, like, a ton of violence in prison, especially, like, gang-related violence, and every single day is super intense, and, like, you're always on edge, and, like, you have to be careful who you're talking to about what, and especially, like, even, like, the prison economics interested me so much, like, how, you know, and Dave explained to me once that, you know, the gang stuff, like, it's extremely prevalent, except in the economics. Like, if you need to buy something and there's a seller, those barriers kind of, like, go down during the sale, which I thought was really cool. So it was just sort of little things like that, like, I had to understand. But the most important thing was understanding, like, how Dave felt at, like, I would say, like, every year of his incarceration right up until his release.
That's a long time, 15 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of growing. I mean, I always say, forget being inside there, like, just who we are. Like, I always tell people, like, why you shouldn't get married too young. Because, like, who you are from 18 to 21, 21 to 25, 25 to 30, 30 to 40, you're four different people.
Right.
So thinking you're going to be in sync with your partner along that way, if you got married at 18 or 20, is like, man, you're rolling the dice. Like, that's really, it's probably not going to work. It's why it usually doesn't, you know?
Right.
You had to go through all of that inside, and still you're maturing and you're changing and you realize, like, your ways, you know, where you went wrong in life and stuff. And some people, like you said, never get it. It's just fascinating.
Yeah. And the biggest thing that I learned, like, during my transformation is the psychological hold that gangs and the lifestyle holds on a person, because, mm-hmm. and the most ironic part about it is, like, you know, most guys that say that they love their mom, they love their kids, but when you join a gang, like, you turn your back on your family like this.
Right.
But, like, when it's time to transition out, most guys, and I'll say, like, most guys on the main line, and nothing against guys who, you know, go S and Y or anything like that, which is sensitive needs yard, or as most people probably know, is protective custody. Nothing against those guys, but, like, for a lot of those guys, it's easier to transition out of gangs because it's like you can't go to your gang anyway. You're in prison, you're considered no good in the lifestyle. So, like, for the guys on the mainline trying to change, it's like that's the hardest grab. Like, I know dudes, and the craziest part about, like, I knew a guy was teaching self-help classes with me. Low-key, I always kind of knew something was kind of, like, off about him, but he knew his stuff. But come to find out, like, this dude was the freaking guy running the yard for the Hispanics.
Hmm.
And I was like, and we had talks. Not about that, because I never knew that until somebody decided to drop a kite and get everybody rolled up. But, like, we would have, like, these really, like, deep talks about change and bettering the community and getting out here for the youth. And I was like, I really don't like this dude, but I know that he'll be a positive and a powerful, like, he'd be a powerful person for change. And that's how like, deeply it holds your mind. Because it's like, but, like, one of the things I did before, like, while changing is I would ask a lot of guys who had already transitioned out of gang lifestyle, you know, in prison. And a lot of guys use religion as their way to get out. And, like, I didn't want to use religion because you got dudes, oh, I'm Christian, I'm Muslim, I'm Jewish. And I always felt like, okay, well, what happens when you're not, like, super orthodox about your religion anymore? Do you go back to the gang? So I didn't want to do that. And I always knew that I need the spiritual connection. So that's where it came from. But it was like, I would ask, how was it for you? Like, how'd you do it? You know, and I remember my good friend Jawad, he's ex-Crip, you know, Muslim guy. And he was like, you know what? When you do decide to do it, they're going to make you feel like you abandoned them. He said, and you're going to feel like you're abandoning them. And I was like, okay. And so then I asked another guy, hey, yo, Musa, he's a Muslim guy. He's from East Palo Alto. And I was like, you know, how do you do it? He's like, give them less and less time. He said, so if you go hang out at the gang table every day, miss one day a week, then you miss 2 days. Then if you go, give them 30 minutes less. Give them. So I was having all these tools, and I was at, because, like, my favorite step in CGA is step two. Like, we look to those who have trudged out of the path of insanity before us. And I always, like, I told them at the board, like, when I joined the gang, I didn't know anything about being a Crip other than they wore blue and said cuz.
Right.
You have to learn how to be a Crip. So you have to unlearn how to be a Crip. You have to unlearn how to do all the things that sent you to prison.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would just pick these older guys' brains. That's all the guys I would, you know, do laps with. Like, one of my workout buddies was actually one of the original founders of the Paroos. And it was so ironic. And I used to tell him, like, here it is. You know, one of the guys who started Paru, anti-Crip thing. And now, like, you work out with me because I was still Cripping. And he was like, yeah, but you're a good dude. And so I would just always ask questions. Like, I was a sponge when it came to, like, rehabilitation. I was like, I need to know everything possible.
Yeah.
Because that's the only way I'll be able to take these chains, you know, of ignorance off of me.
When you got out that first day, is it like, now what?
You know what? It was just so surreal.
Yeah.
I remember getting in the back of the police car. And
they drove you out?
Yeah, they drive us to the bus station. And I remember getting, and it was, you know what? This is the craziest thing about it, because I'm like, go to R&R, getting ready to get released, and they have the wrong social.
No way.
They actually had my dad's social. And my heart is pounding.
And you're like, do I say something?
I'm like, no, they knew it was the wrong one.
Okay, okay.
And they're like, wait a minute. I'm like, they're like, what's your social? So I say it. Not going to say it now, scammers.
Yeah.
So I say it, and they're like, this is the wrong one. And I was like, no, it's not. They're like, no, they say something else. And I was like, well, I'm a junior. I'm like, that's probably my fucking dad's social security number. And I'm just sitting there, and I'm like, they're going to have to call every cop that's in this freaking, they're going to have to call all the COs. I am not leaving R&R tonight. I'm like, well, in the morning, I am not leaving this place.
Yeah.
And so he called the watch commander, and they got it resolved. And I was like,
quick?
No. Hours? It might have been quick, but it felt like quick, eternity. But it felt like I was getting resentenced. I'm like starting to shake. I'm like, oh my gosh. I'm like, I'm gonna punch this dude. You know, you're the one trying to stop me from getting out of prison. So they let us out. Now I'm looking. I'm like, whoa. Like I'm outside of the prison.
Do they buy you the bus ticket?
No. So they give you. And they're trying to change it too. It doesn't matter how much time you do. You can do 3 months, or you can do 30 years. They give you $200 on a prepaid credit card to restart life.
Come on.
And part of the money you have to use to get home,
which is $100 at least.
Exactly. So
you have $8.
But the bus tickets are like really cheap. It's Greyhound, right?
Okay.
And so I remember getting in the back of the squad car, and I'm just like, and I remember because it was a Hispanic guy getting really, I think, yo, this is the first time I've ever been in the back of a police car without being cuffed.
Mm.
I'm like, this is so surreal. I'm just like looking at like the beautiful landscape as we're driving.
Yeah.
And it was so funny because I went to Sacramento bus stop, called my aunt. Just so happened somebody had a cell phone. I'm like, dude, can I use your phone? Y'all don't got to touch it. Put it on speaker. So my aunt ordered me an Uber. I didn't even know anything about Ubers.
You didn't even know what Uber was, right?
Yeah, I'm like, oh, what happened to the taxis?
Right.
And so the Uber picks me up, takes me to the airport. I got to use my prison ID to buy a ticket. And so I remember getting on the airplane. Well, before I got on the airplane, I bought a hamburger and a beer.
Uh-huh.
Because I always heard people in prison talk, like free staff, always like, yeah, you know, if you have a hamburger, you got to have a beer. Just like if you have a hot dog. And I was like, oh, okay, that's what adults are doing, right?
Uh-huh.
So I bought that, and I was like, hey, I'm a fucking adult now. You know, so I get on the airplane. Like, it should have been obvious I was, like, fresh out of prison because, like, everybody has cell phones, and I'm just sitting around just looking around. Right. And this lady's playing a game on her phone. I wanted to tell her, like, can I see your phone?
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm like, yeah, but that'd probably be really, really awkward. So just getting off, and it just was, like, so surreal. Got back to LAX. First thing I did was go get a cell phone. Then I went to the mall, and I had like an anxiety attack because there was so many people and everybody's just moving so fast. Because in prison, we all move slow and we move with respect.
Right.
You know, and I'll do air quotes because it's not true respect. It's more of fear.
Sure.
And, you know, you tell somebody.
Don't piss anyone off.
Basically. Right. If you walk up on, and I still do it to this day, it's an old habit. But I kind of like it that if I'm walking up on you in the store, I'll say, hey, right behind you, or hey, left side, just kind of give you a heads up.
Yeah.
And so it's like so many people.
Does it bother you when someone comes up on left or right or behind you?
Well, I'm like super hyper vigilant.
Right.
So like I'm always seeing
you're
things.
Switched on.
Yeah,
still.
I can hear people walking.
Right.
And so like I'll like easily like walk and I'll just be like, all right, I see this dude. And what pisses me off is like, how close people walk towards you, you know, like even if they're walking this way, it's like there's a whole lot of space for you to just get the hell out of my way.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I want to just grab people like, do you see that your space? Get your ass over there. But it's like, that's how they are. That's, you know, so that's kind of like my own little pet peeve with society is just,
yeah.
But I understand it. Everybody's on a like hustle and bustle. Everybody's trying to like, and that doing security. Because I love to people watch because I was incarcerated for so long.
That's what you do.
And you can't really look at guards too long, especially like the female guards. You know, it's kind of always like, you know. So, like, I take drives and just, like, watch people. During security, I just watch people. And, like, my conclusion is, like, everybody's just trying to get to where they're trying to go and get through the day. So, like, that's where I have the empathy. Like, all right, you know, people aren't, like,
they're not intentionally out to get
trying
you.
To be rude.
Right.
It's just... And you don't know what people are going through. You know, we make a lot of assumptions all the time.
100%.
You know, a guy bumps you and doesn't say anything. You think, oh, what an asshole. But no, maybe his wife's water just broke. Maybe his mom just died. Right. He's trying to hurry up and get
he's
to where
he's
going to go.
He's right.
So I try to just, you know, not make the assumptions about people and just try to, I just try to give everybody the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. Was it hard to do that at first?
Not really because I didn't want to go back to jail. And I knew like if I held on to like that, I was going to remain like a prisoner.
Yeah.
In my mind. And then it would eventually send me back to prison in real life. So I just kind of like know where I came from.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, it's not worth it because, number one, I'm going to piss on the backs of everybody that's trying to come home. Mm-hmm. I'm going to piss on the backs of everybody who's made it possible for guys to be able to come home. And then the embarrassment of going back, hey, what are you in jail for? Like, man, I freaking socked this Irish dude named Killian for fucking bumping me. They're like, are you fucking serious? Like, you had life in prison, and now you're back for hitting somebody for bumping you?
Right.
And, like, then I would have to just live with that embarrassment and shame, and then I would shame my family all over again, the people who believed in me.
Right. And so if some – you certainly you made some friends while you're in there.
A lot of – like, all my friends are ex-convicts.
Now, if any of them get out, are you technically not even allowed to associate with them, or how does that work?
So I'm not on parole.
Okay.
Yeah, I got off parole.
Oh, once you're free, you're free.
After you get off parole, you're free.
Got it. Okay.
Because while you're on parole, you still belong to the state of California.
Okay.
And so I say it now because we're all off parole, but me and all my buddies, he knows Keith, and we were on parole going to exercise like every Sunday, going on hikes. And I remember one time, dude, this was the most funniest thing. We're coming back from the Culver City Stairs, and he got out a year before me, and the police get right behind us. And we are sweating harder than when we were hiking. He's like, bro, the police are behind us. I was like, oh my God. And I was like,
isn't it crazy doing nothing wrong, really? I mean, you know right. what I mean? Like, you're on the up
it's
and up.
It's a technical violation, right, not right. like a real, like, right. we're going and knocking over stores right. or anything. But it was just like, we're both, because I was on lifer's parole. Like, if I go back, I go back with a life sentence. Keith, we always say that he's a fake lifer because he had 30 years,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I don't know if you met Dominique.
No, I didn't.
But Dominique's another one of our friends. And me and Dominique had life
okay.
in prison. We actually met in juvenile hall. And we always be like, freaking fake ass lifer. Mm-hmm. So he would have just had like a violation, you know, but I would have had to go before the board again. And then the question is, you had the rules.
Right.
This is showing that you're antisocial.
Right.
You're not pro-social.
Right.
You know, and the only thing I would have been able to do is just like cry and just tell them to give me some psych meds because yeah. I wouldn't have been able to live with it.
Yeah.
You know, so, but yeah, like all my entire circle for the maybe one or two guys, if we've all been in prison together. If you look on my Instagram, I have a picture. When you go to my profile, it's my favorite picture ever. Everybody in the picture, it's for my birthday. Everybody in the picture, we're not only in the same prison, but we're in the same building together.
Wow.
And now we were all free.
Wow.
Just having a blast. Like, and I just like, to this day, there's not a picture other than my mom and brother that can trump that picture.
How long have you been out?
I've been out almost 3 years. April 21st of this year will be 3 years.
What is there that you want to do that you haven't done yet?
I want to be able to just do what I'm doing, but professionally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to be able to go
get paid to speak.
Yeah, get paid to speak,
inspire people, and
help motivate
change.
The youth, yeah. and also work closely with people to understand returning citizens.
Yep.
You know, because I definitely understand it. Because even with my own family, you have to earn the trust back. Because it's like, okay, David's home, but is he going to go back to all that? Because so many guys in jail have what we call prison blues. You know, let's say I'm your son. Dad, you know, and I'm in there for a drug. Dad, when I get out, I'll never do that. You know, and then I get out, the first chance I get, I'm getting high again. It's like, yeah, we knew it. So mm-hmm. you have to build the trust of your family. So I just want to show people in a motivational and inspirational way, like, look, these guys coming home will help society so much more than even just guys who just want to just do motivational speaking, who had humble beginnings and rose to like high ranks. It's like, that is very commendable. But imagine the kid like myself who joined a gang at 15, went to jail by the age of 17 with a life sentence. Mom dies, brother dies, has every excuse in the book to never change his life. But he does. And now he can talk to your son who's going through everything that you don't understand.
Right. Yeah, it's huge.
You know? And it was also a motivation to create my own clothing brand. I actually drew this when I was in prison. It's called Stay Great Above Hate. And so it's anti-bullying. And people always think the bullying is like, give me your cookies and stuff like that. Like, no. Anybody who's ever been like counted out based on race, religion, sexual orientation, economic, socioeconomical status, you've been bullied.
Yeah.
And so this is for you because people are going to hate no matter what. Whether you're doing the best you can, they're going to still talk about you. Your only goal is to stay great above hate. So that's what I want to be able to do professionally. I want to just be able to just – I want to be able to sell out the crypto.com arena and have people pay to hear me like just speak and give them wisdom and inspire them to be better.
You're going
to
get there.
From your
you're
going
to get there.
Your mouth I'm to God's
positive
ears.
You're going to get there.
I accept it, man.
Have you had any contact with the family members of the victim?
So I have not had any personal contact with them. And if they ever would want to do it, I would. You know, even if it's just for them to just tell me how much of a piece of shit they believe I am.
Yep.
I owe them that. But in order to successfully earn parole, you do have to write a remorse letter to the victim's family. Okay. Or if your victim is still alive. And so, and I just wanted to say this real fast because I say victim not out of disrespect. It's out of respect for the victim of my crime and their family. I don't like to say their name just because I don't never want, oh, hey, I heard if that guy did the one killed. And it reopens up because I don't know how Got much it. They've healed.
And they may not even know, or do they know?
They know I'm, they yeah, know. They call and they have to inform them that I'm
Got it.
Coming home. So I did write a letter to them. And so.
You don't know any feedback from it though?
No. And if they never forgive me, that's. Just
you understand,
yeah, because I don't deserve to be forgiven.
Yeah, is it hard to say that?
No, I put in the work and I understand.
Yeah.
What I did, I've done an unrightable wrong, you know. So yeah. I definitely accept. That's my scarlet letter.
Yeah, is it tough to still live with it?
In a
way,
yeah, because it's like when people do you know see the greatness in me. It's still that is the reminder. That's right. Still the residue that can never be washed away.
Yeah.
And I always say, like, for me, it's motivating because it reminds me to never give up on myself.
Yeah.
Because I seen what a scumbag I was. And so that's why I'm like, every day is living amends.
Yeah. Wow, man. It's really amazing. It's just an amazing story. It really is. You know?
You should read the book.
Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait to read the book. I'm absolutely going to read the book. I'm glad I didn't do any homework prior, but now I'm going to OD on your content for sure. And so you're working security now? And
no, I actually work as a mental health worker.
Oh.
Yeah, in a BHU in the psych unit.
Wow.
Yeah, so I deal with psych patients. And you know what? That is very, very humbling as well because it also allows me to continue my living amends by being of service to others.
Yeah.
It's not about me at that job at all. You know, even during security, it's not about me.
Right.
It's about making sure that everybody else is safe, which in my prior life, I didn't give a shit if you were safe or not. So it's still a living amend. So I love doing that, you know.
What were the other three books that you wrote? What was the subject matter?
One is pure fiction.
Yeah.
There's another book that's mostly fiction. It's kind of inspired by this musician I knew in Boston that moved out to LA, did like a giant road trip, and then had sort of like a mental breakdown and had to put the pieces of his life back together. And he did that through music. The third book I wrote was very similar to my experience with Dave. I interviewed a woman for a month who was married to the headmaster of a very prestigious boarding school in New England. I'm not allowed to say which one, but one day the FBI came knocking on her door and they told her that her husband was being accused of sexual assault by five of his former students. So she had to become like a spy within her own home and help the FBI take him down. But the thing is, he was always sort of one step ahead. A totally true story. It's fucking awesome. It has like a little bit of like an acid-tongued ending because it's a totally true story. The Spotlight team at the Boston Globe actually investigated it after they investigated the Catholic Church. So it was like massive deal. Oh my, they found like
the big story of the Catholic Church.
67 different boarding schools were caught with at least one sexual assault charge between a member of faculty and a student. So I heard about that story. I did all of that work, and then that sort of like kickstarted my interest in like investigative storytelling. So when I heard Dave's story, I was all over it. And then this past October, I was sort of hired, sort of like told about a story down in Panama. So I went to Panama for a month to interview a bunch of people. I'm currently writing that book now as well.
Wow. Good, man. Well, man, I can't thank you guys enough for coming in and sharing all this. You know, I told you when we first started this, Adam Clausen is the one guy that changed how I view people that have been incarcerated for doing awful things. And now there's two.
Man, that really, I appreciate that so much.
Thank you for coming in, man. Thanks. All right, Lana, me. I don't know if you know how to end the show. Don't fuck this up, Lana. Don't fuck this up. But push whatever fucking buttons. And is there a button that says stop or end? Or
well, I was
going to transition to the thing.
Outro.
Yeah, like right now. Like, there you go.